And this is the Union Edge Labor's Talk Radio. Nathan Ruggles here with you. Glad you're able to be with us today. We'd like to send some thanks out to a couple of the many organizations and unions that keep our programming going here at the Union Edge. The West Virginia AFL-CIO, as well as the Kentucky AFL-CIO, two of those organizations. So here we are in the studio on Wednesday, and it means we have Just Transitions, Labor, Environment, and Health here with Patty DeMarco. Patty, so glad to have you back in the studio once
again
with us.
Thank you, Nathan. It's good to be here on this beautiful, beautiful summer day. And it is my great joy and delight to have my good friend Veronica Koptis for the Center for Coalfield Justice, their new executive director, with us. Veronica, congratulations on your position, and welcome to our show. Glad to have you here today.
Thanks. I'm excited to be here today.
Congratulations.
Yeah, it's a couple months in.
And it's,
but I had worked for the organization many years, for a long time before I took over.
Okay,
as
so it's not completely unfamiliar not what's going on.
Yeah. Okay. Well, she's been the stalwart of the organization for a long time. And I really, maybe you could share with our audience what it is that the Center for Coalfield Justice does and why it's such an important organization at this time.
Yeah, the Center for Coalfield Justice is a local environmental justice advocacy organization, and we work in the heart of the coalfields in southwestern PA in Washington and Greene County. I actually grew up and still live in Greene County, PA, and we work with people that are directly impacted by fossil fuel extraction. So they're either having something happen to their home or a place they love to recreate from coal mining or shale gas extraction or fracking in our communities. And our work is really to mobilize, educate, and advocate and hold our elected officials, our government agencies, and corporations accountable to their actions and to make sure that they're not allowed to just exploit our communities because we may be smaller and less and have less money than other communities.
Right. That's really, it's important to recognize that the people who live in these communities aren't necessarily getting the benefits of these extractive practices. And even though there are some jobs associated, this is a lot more mechanized industry than it ever was before. And the communities are often devastated by the effects of these kinds of extractive practices.
Yeah, I mean, the common myth is probably everyone living in the coal fields is working for a coal mine or a support injury industry of the coal mine.
What, everyone down there isn't working for a coal mine?
And that is exactly not the case. Okay. The statistic is actually that 20% of the people that live in Greene County are actually working in the energy sector. And that's not just coal. That's gas, lumber, support, any type of energy sector. Mm-hmm. 20% of our population is working.
What do the rest of them do?
The service sector is huge in our community. There's also, you know, the handful of school districts that we have, hospitals, there's some education and medicine careers, and then also some agriculture and just entrepreneurship. There's a lot of, I mean, our downtown strip in Waynesburg, PA is really cute. There's a lot of cute stores, artists that are selling things. And so we're not just coal. Right. And our communities, we're much more than that.
Right. And actually, the Center for Coalfield Justice does a great deal in the way of transitioning communities to more robust economic futures, right? It's one of your...
Yeah, I mean, the economic crisis we're in right now is because our elected officials and the companies have created a single source economy, and putting all of our eggs in one basket has put us in the situation we are now, is what happens as the coal industry is realizing they can no longer profit off of our resource and labor. And so we are working to diversify our community and make sure that people have more economic choice, which will help make our communities less depressed than they are right now.
That's very important. That's a very important aspect. And there have been a number of initiatives that have moved in that direction in coal country, actually. And can you share with us some of the more successful initiatives that you've been doing?
Well, we've mostly been having conversations with community members about how, as this transition is inevitably going to happen, no matter what folks are in their belief stage right now in coal country, is that... As that happens, this is our opportunity to ensure that our economy is community-owned and community-controlled. Mm-hmm. And what has put us in the situations we're in today is that we've allowed outside interests or entities to come in and dictate what our job options are. And now it's our moment to totally take that over and dictate what we want for our community and not let an outside interest do it for us.
Can you tell us what those conversations... How do you have those conversations? What are those conversations like?
So we started with the Coalfield Listening Project initially, and And we realized as the Center for Coalfield Justice, I at that time, several years ago, was the only staff member who was from the community, that our staff couldn't make this decision either. And so we went and we interviewed about 30 people throughout the community and asked them questions just about what they valued, what they cared about, what were their concerns. And the last question we asked them is if they had all the resources in the world, what would their community look like? And people had a hard time answering it. And that was a real eye-opening moment for us, that the oppression that's happened in these communities for the last century has prevented a lot of our community members from even being able to have the vision or hope of, if they had the power, what would it be?
To imagine a different, different future. Now, when you say listening project, is that capital L, capital P listening project?
Yes, yes.
Oh, very good. Yeah. Okay. I worked on one myself in the past. So, okay.
And so from that, it made us realize that we have to go to the basic building blocks and reinstill the hope and the power and build skills and training in our community so that the folks living here have the resources and the skills they need to move forward as our economy is going to be shifting in the near future.
That's very exciting, because then you really begin having a dialogue about creating new possibilities, and people get excited about that. You know, I've attended a workshop that the League of Women Voters did in Indiana, PA, where there was a community visioning process going on, and I was involved in helping to lead that. And it's really exciting when you get that spark of possibility happening, and people begin to see that they have an alternate fate that they can control.
Yeah, and it's really making it clear that we have a right and we deserve to have a say, and that's something that the exact opposite has been told to us for a long time.
Right, yeah.
Is it safe to say that when you said the eggs in one basket in terms of the economy, do you have the impression from all these conversations that you are having that people, their imagination is kind of in one basket as well? That's kind of, is it to a degree, is that true or not?
Their
thought is kind of caught up in one basket. And
a lot of, so it's hard. So a lot of the towns, especially along the river in Greene and Washington counties, they're coal towns, coal patch towns. They've only existed because 100, 200 years ago, a coal company came in, said, I want to extract a resource here. I'm going to build a company town. And then as the unions mobilized and formed, the coal patch towns remained. But coal is very much a part of our identity. In moving to an economy that's not controlled by coal doesn't mean we have to forget our identity to coal and how important it was to our history. And actually, there's such a history of resistance in our history with coal too, that is not taught. Like in high school in Greene County, I never once learned about one of the union battles that happened in our backyard.
Yeah.
And that's intentional.
Yeah.
And so.
So reviving your history.
Reviving and relearning our union history. And whenever we say we're honoring our ancestors by mining coal, we're actually honoring our ancestors by challenging the company as well.
Yeah, because they did. The unions did challenge the company for safety issues, for wage issues, for hours issues and working conditions. And if it hadn't been for the unions, it would have been, I mean, my ancestors came here and they were coal miners from Italy, you know, and those were the days when it was dagos are cheaper than props. And it didn't matter how many of them went under, you know. And I think that whole mentality of resisting exploitation,
I also think
really
it just shows whenever you organize and work together, you have power. So it doesn't matter what oppressive issue is coming to your community or what entity is coming in and trying to exploit something. If you try to fight it by yourself, you're not going to win. But if you fight it collectively as a community, you're going to win.
That's really very much true today, too, in terms of the whole issue of diversifying the economy. It isn't something you can do unilaterally, right?
Right. And diversifying the economy is larger than bringing in new industry. It's lifting up existing industry that's not tied to fossil fuels that exist, but it's also raising the wage. So we have the giant service sector in our community that's keeping people in perpetuity poverty in our communities. They were poor to grow up with. They go work for McDonald's again. They're still poor. So unless we break that cycle, we're just going to keep having an extremely poor county. And whenever you give people those choices by paying them a living wage, that gives them the ability to actually pull themselves up by their bootstraps and get out of poverty and make something even bigger for themselves.
Well, very good. So we have environmental and workers' concerns all and community concerns all tied up together here.
Yeah.
So we do need to go to a break.
Okay, we'll take a break. All right. And when we come back, we'll talk about the Fort Ryerson Station State Park and the role that that has played in your community regeneration too.
Yeah, we're very excited to talk about Ryerson.
Good. Okay, when we come back, that's what we'll do.
Farm workers and community members are demanding accountability from Sarbanan Farms in Whatcom County after a worker died there over the weekend. Workers say Ernesto Silva Ibarra complained to his employer about feeling ill before he collapsed in the field last week. Ibarra took himself to a hospital in Seattle, where he fell into a coma and died on Sunday. About 100 workers drawing attention to what they say are unsafe work conditions at Sarbanan Farms were fired over the weekend. All are here on H-2A or guest worker visas. Rosalinda Guillen of Community to Community Development says Canadian wildfires are affecting the health of many who work in agriculture.
There's just a lot of physical and health issues with the workers, both inside and out, because of the stress and also the overwork. Poor nutrition from the food that they're being fed, the hard work in these hard conditions right now. The air quality is so bad with the smoke from Canada, it's been building up for several weeks.
The fired workers are camping about a mile away from Sarbanan Farms and marched to the management office on Tuesday. The Washington State Department of Labor says it is looking into the incident, but Guillen says the agency has yet to reach out to any of the farm workers. The workers also discovered their work visas expired a month ago. Under the guest worker program, employers are responsible for renewing visas. Guillen says it is peak blueberry picking season, meaning there are long hours in the fields right now.
It's been pretty exploitative and abusive, and those of us that live in Whatcom County are just outraged and really upset about the way that these farm workers at Sarbanan Farm are being treated. And the fact that we had a farm worker die on our watch is sitting really heavy on us.
Guillen thinks the governor's office should investigate the state's guest worker program. Washington State had more than 13,500 jobs approved by the H-2A Farm Labor Program in 2016, the fourth highest in the nation. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 66, works with builders and contractors to build a better community. Local 66's tradesmen and women have received the specialty training needed to meet the complex challenges of any project, making them the most capable workforce in the region. From schools, highways, and pipeline projects to casinos and arenas, the operating engineers build any job, large or small. For over 100 years, Local 66 has provided superior service that our community can count on. They are your one-stop resource for qualified and productive operating engineers and heavy equipment mechanics. To learn more about the benefits of organized labor and more information about the International Union of Operating Engineers Local 66, go to www.iuoe66.org. That's www.iuoe66.org.
Hey y'all, I'm Blake Shelton. I love that country music connects people all over this great nation, but unfortunately so does something else, childhood hunger. 15 million children struggle with hunger in America. That's why the Feeding America nationwide network of food banks works to rescue our surplus food to help provide billions of meals to families in need across the country. Join the fight against hunger at feedingamerica.org. Together, we can solve hunger. Together, we're Feeding America.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
And you're listening to the Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio. This is Nathan Ruggles here with you. Thanks for joining us. And our thanks going out to the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, as well as United Mine Workers for their support for this and our programming here. All of our shows here with the Working Family Radio Network and the Union Edge. So we're in the midst of Just Transitions, Labor, Environment, and Health here with Patty DeMarco with us back here in the studio. An exciting discussion talking about the communities seizing power, having hope, having their identity go beyond coal and into the future. So it's a great discussion, Patty, here.
With Veronica Koptis, the Executive Director of the Center for Coalfield Justice. And one of the things that you've been doing for quite a while has been working on Ryerson Station State Park, which is right on top of the Bailey, 5, 6, and 7 longwall mines?
Just the Bailey mine.
Just the Bailey Mine has a lot of different sections. Yeah. So that's been going on as a battle for quite a while.
Yeah, we, in 2005, the Duke Lake at Ryerson Station State Park had to be drawn down due to subsidence damage from longwall mining on the dam. And ever since then, the Center for Coalfield Justice has been engaged in a very aggressive accountability campaign to first get the dam restored. And there was a lot of litigation as well as organizing to pressure the company to fix the dam as well as our state government to hold them accountable to that. And then a settlement from that had happened in 2013 with a promise that the dam was going to be restored, only to find out a year or two later that the dam can never be restored because the ground is continuing to move, which is likely a result of additional mining happening in the area. And so our fight right now is really around protecting the remaining water resources in the park. So there are still several headwater streams in the main stem of North Fork, Dunkard Fork that are left, but they're all proposed to have predicted damage to them from an ongoing underground longwall mining operation. Some where the permit has been issued and we're in a legal challenge on that right now. But this beginning of this year, in one of our legal challenges, we filed for a supersedious, which is asking for a halt to the operations to protect the resource during the ongoing legal appeal so that it's not destroyed forever. And we won. Consol had to stop mining 100 feet before Kent Run, which is a headwater stream in the state park, and cut their mining short. And that's the first time that the company has been forced to cut their operations short, that it wasn't their choice to do so. And the judge agreed with our concerns about the permanent damage that might happen if they were allowed to move forward. And we're still moving forward with that. We just recently had a large campaign against Senate Bill 624 that was proposed in April. And it was an amendment to the mining law that essentially exempted the longwall mining coal industry from the Clean Streams Act and would say that predicted pollution is now allowed to be permitted as long as there's a plan to fix it.
Is there any way to fix it when you've dewatered a stream?
I have yet to see in the community a dewater stream to be totally restored to pre-mining conditions.
It's okay to damage it as long as you fix it.
You have a plan to fix
it. Well, obviously, yeah. In the case of the dam, in any case, they have not been able to fix it, as you just
described. And it doesn't take an expert. If you talk to anybody in these communities, they know very well that their water wells don't come back after mining, that their houses continue to move after mining, that this isn't just a one-and-done deal. And there are already several other streams in the same watershed that have been dewatered, and the state has determined that all efforts to try to restore them have been exhausted, and they're not able to be restored to original condition. Right. So it's not even like we're saying in this watershed specifically that this is a crazy thing. Like, this has legit happened under this terrain and this geology and these set of specific facts. And that if you know that's going to happen, you not only have a responsibility to not allow it to happen under our laws, but under our Constitution as well. And so... Yeah, Article 1, Section 27, our Environmental Rights Amendment. And our litigation is moving forward, even though so the governor, unfortunately, made it very clear that he's not willing to stand with environmental justice communities and let this become law without his signature, even after there were thousands of calls and letters into his office asking him to veto the legislation. And there, longwall mining only happens in two counties in the entire state.
And explain to, when you say longwall mining, for people that may not understand, in a nutshell.
Yeah. Longwall mining is an extreme form of underground mining that removes the entire coal seam underground, causing the geology and earth above it to fall in, which creates structural or strain on the surface, resulting in subsidence damage. So if your home is above this, your foundation will crack. You'll have damage happen to your home. If you have a private drinking water, your aquifer will drain further down and you'll lose your drinking water source. And in the case of streams, the stream bed itself can crack and fissure, causing the water to drain not in the stream bed and dry up an entire stream. When you hear the word dewater, it literally means dewatering the entire stream.
The water leaks into the lower cracks in the ground.
So if you're literally taking a brick out of the foundation of your house, obviously something is going to happen.
Right. Yeah. In the industry's response is that we're trying to litigate a ban on longwall mining, and we're doing everything but that with this litigation. We're just saying in the unique cases when they predict and they know that significant damage is going to happen to a stream, that they need to leave support underneath of that stream. And actually, by leaving more support under streams that are predicted to have this extreme damage would require more labor cost. So it in turn could result in more jobs if the company was willing to do that. But this fight has been very clear that CONSOL Energy is not interested in providing more jobs. They're interested at extracting as much coal as they can, the very least amount of cost.
And this is a highly mechanized process. The longwall mine process is huge machinery that really uses relatively few workers, right? It has
Yeah, it's a form of underground mining that has low labor cost and high production rates. Right. So these mines produce, on average, 25 to 30 million tons of coal a year.
Right.
Now describe to us the efforts you had to organize people in the community in this fight.
How
have you done that and how that's going?
We hold a festival every year called the Dryerson Festival. It's a big, fun event at the state park that community members come to get updates on what's going on, actions they can take. But we also have a lot of phone calls. I mean, this is a very rural community, so the door knocking or some of the techniques you might use in the city don't really portray well in a rural
you
community.
You can door knock, but that's...
It would take a long time.
Yes.
And so we have a lot of phone conversations. We will visit with people in the community and talk about it. And in this case, we actually brought several people from the community to Harrisburg to talk directly with the governor's staff. And so we really felt if the governor was not going to veto this legislation, throughout the process, he had to look us directly in the eyes and know exactly who he was letting feel that their environment doesn't matter over his environment in York County.
And this is, I think, a really important aspect of this because it is an environmental justice issue. The Ryerson State Park is really one of the only recreational areas that still has pristine trout streams and places where people can go to be attracting tourism and even to enjoy just as family
Yeah, I grew up 5 minutes from this state park. I spent my entire childhood at this state park, as did many of my friends.
Right.
And then we lost the lake when I was a high school senior, and an entire generation has missed the opportunity to recreate and enjoy this state park.
We're slowly running out of time, but how large is the park and the lake that was
The park
lost?
Is a little over 1,000 acres, and the lake was 62 acres.
Right. It is a significant recreational attribute of the whole area and a focus of the community. And
I mean, the park was designed around the lake. It was the feature. It would be like going to Ohio Pile and not having the falls.
Yeah. So I really applaud your efforts, and I'd like to be able to put out on the air where people can go to find out more information about the Center for Coalfield Justice and some of your upcoming events that you might want to promote.
Folks should go to our website, which is www.coalfieldjustice.org. The latest news tab is where you'll find the updates of everything that's going on and to sign up for our mailing list. We also encourage folks to donate and support our work on the front lines. And if you want to come to a really fun event on September 30th, we're having our fall fundraiser, a party in the park at Washington, PA, at the Washington Park, and you can buy tickets for that event. They're $20 per person, which includes dinner, a drink, and a raffle ticket and live music to the event. So we hope to see you all there or checking out our news on our blog.
Excellent. Well, Veronica, thank you so much for all that you're doing for the Coalfield community and for the Center for Coalfield Justice. I wish you all the best in your work, and thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks
for
having me, Patty.
You're welcome. Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Take care. This is Just Transitions, Labor, Environment, and Health on Union Edge Labor Talk Radio. Bye-bye.